Dave Max Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
In this episode, I talk to Adrian Russell, author of The Double, How Cork Made GAA History.
The double has been achieved!
A story full of stories, set in an Ireland now gone, then in transition. A sun-kissed summer of ole olés as Italia 90 fever raged and Prince brought sex and outrage in equal measure down the park. A summer culminating in two epic weeks in September when Cork swept all before them and everyone with them.
Sam Maguire goes proudly back to Leaside. It's Sam and it's Liam in the 1 year for Cork.
From the Canon O'Brien's statement of intent, number plate 90C27, to Babs Keating's infamous donkeys don't win derbies, to a game for the ages where the Rebels overcame Cyril Farrell and Tony Keady's tribesmen 515 to 221 for their 27th Liam McCarthy. From Billy Morgan's Fuck the Bus We'll Walk and Lock the Gates and Make Them Watch, to two consecutive final defeats to Sean Boylan and Jerry McEntee's Meath before the win over Mayo set up a double within a double and Royal County redemption. 11-9 as Cork's fourth final in a row saw Sam Maguire return home for the sixth time. It's a story full of stories and full of characters. From Tomás Mulcahy to Larry Tompkins to Kevin Hennessy, John Cairns, Jer Cunningham, the double-winning Teddy McCarthy, and of course, the special sauce that glued them all together, John the Kid Cronin. So settle back and join me as we delve deep on The Double. Adrian Russell, you're the editor of the42.ie and author of The Double, How Cork Made GAA History. Well, actually, we're recording this on the day, 2nd of September 2020, exactly 30 years to the day that the Hurlers did step one of what is still like an incredible achievement. Ironically, the double was done 100 years after it in a form had been done before. What's that story?
Yeah, so in 1890, GAA was still at the stage where it was an inter-county setup. It was the county champions, the club teams went forward to represent the counties. So it was Midland and Arbuthnot went forward and they both managed to win the All-Ireland Series. But yeah, I suppose 100 years later, remarkably, the fact that it was, you know, a full century later and the only time since really the county team managed to pull it off. Yeah, the stars aligned.
Galway maybe and Dublin by virtue of numbers potentially could do it. But, yeah. You know, it just adds to how incredible an achievement it is that so few counties could even dream of such a thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like traditionally, probably Galway would have been the other county who would, you know, like to think they'd pull it off if things came together for them, even though they have, you know, in fairness, far less titles than Cork. But no, yeah, in the modern game, like Dublin Hurlers aren't in the position this year, I would say, or next year even to do it. But, you know, it's really popular game in parts of Dublin that hasn't been in the past.
Were you aware before you wrote the book of the depth of stories that lay behind it?
I knew those.
I mean, obviously, it's a story in and of itself, and the cut and thrust of sport in itself has stories, but this thing is jam-packed full of stuff.
Yeah, I wasn't sure, to be honest, until I got stuck into it, that there was a book in it. I knew the characters were there, but I didn't realise, probably that there was the depth of stories there. And what I kind of quickly realised, and people have said to me, is that the footballers themselves, their kind of 4 or 5 or even 6 year arc is a story and a book in itself.
And weirdly, because, you know, I think everybody knows that hurling shines brighter in Cork than the football does. But it's the football story is the heart of this. At least there's more colourful aspects to it, particularly the matchup with Meath. Before we go into it, so you've Billy Morgan. I mean, what a character he is. A driven man and an explosive man. What a power of personality he must have. He's matched up in a way against Mick O'Dwyer and ultimately then Sean Boylan Meath.
Yeah.
On the other side, you've Father O'Brien, Gerald McCarthy, the trainer of the team, but Father O'Brien, the character who led them through. And they're matched up then nicely as well.
Yeah, there's a nice balance from my point of view in the, you know, the
Cyril Farrell Galway, Babs Keating Tip. Yeah, so, you know, like that, and that's just behind the scenes, never mind on the pitch.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's a dream, really, from an author's point of view, isn't it? So, like, you could make the argument that, you know, Father O'Brien in particular and Billy Morgan, they kind of created something through that kind of force of personality for different reasons. Like, the Hurlers obviously would have a huge tradition, and they were, you know, the top hurling team at that stage. traditionally, I would mean, like, but at the same time, they had been done for a few years, so the canon had to come, the canon, as he became known as, like, the canon came in and had to create something really and kind of convince people that something existed, whereas Billy had to kind of, you know, break Kerry's stranglehold and kind of pull a team together and convince people that they could do this, like, and then, as you say, they got over one kind of monster, as it was put in the book, I think, and then, you know, they're facing Meade, another bigger monster almost down the line.
Like, and that's what left them down the first time around, is they got through Kerry and sort of that had been the ambition and hadn't looked beyond that horizon and then found, oh, but look, at you got to get over the first step first,
yeah,
don't
exactly,
you?
Exactly, yeah. You know, yourself in sports, that often happens, doesn't it? You kind of have to lose one to win one or whatever. Larry Tompkins makes the point. As you said, they were focused on Kerry, and that was the big thing. Like, I mean, they had lost so many times down at Killarney and down the park, and been.
Well, look, I think we'll start on the football in a minute, but just the cannon arriving in with the Reg plate.
Yeah.
Like, what an entrance! Would he have been familiar to everybody in the setup? Yes, it wasn't his first time in with the.
No, he was co-coach or co-manager, I think, was the term in '84 with Justin McCarthy, and it was a successful year.
Yes, although that. They didn't get on so well, did they?
Well, at the time they did, I think, but like a lot of things, maybe a lot of times in Cork GAA, they probably fell out afterwards. Like.
No, he wrote something. He wrote something after.
Yeah, I don't think the canon was particularly pleased with how he was portrayed in Justin McCarthy's. The way he was portrayed afterwards, and there wasn't enough credit given maybe to him as he saw it.
But then again, just again, how colourful the canon is, like he'd be he'd be high and low in the, like, do the lads want me at all, seemed to be a refrain through the thing. Do they want me at all?
Yeah, well, he was a big into the mind games, as a lot of players told me. Like, the Reg you kind of references he made, he was big on entrances and big on exits, like, and he came in a new Ford with the licence plate 90C27, which was a way of for him to kind of say, look lads, you've won 26, or as a county we've won 26, I believe that we want to win 27 this year, and that this is how much I believe in you. I've registered my car that way. But like Tomás McGahey would tell you, like, he often just swept out of training halfway through, gathered up the slitters and would leave, because he just wanted to, the lads, which they did, were all looking at each other and asking what's happened to Father O'Brien here, like, and he'd come back in and say, look, I'll give you one more try, and, you know, the training will go up a few levels, and like, he was really good at the man management stuff, I would say. Like, Mourinho has been a John Constantine compared
even
him to
though it, as you wrote it, it felt like less calculated and more almost natural.
Yeah.
He probably did throw a huff and storm off.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. I think there was definitely an element of histrionics and, like, theatre, I suppose. Like, and, you know, he was one of those, you remember those old, maybe they still exist, but the old school type of priests who are great at, you know, oratory and sermons and all the rest of it. And he was that, and he was very inspirational. But, I mean, he had the track record to back it up. He'd won 10 Fitzgibbon Cups with Cork.
That's right. Actually, it was incredible. Go on, yeah, give us that.
So, like he had an amazing tradition. Like, he'd kind of masterminded St. Finn Bar's Fran Ferris, Harty Cup wins, and 10 in a row with UCC and the Fitzgibbon. He'd been involved with a lot of these players underage and under-21 teams, and he had great pedigree, like, obviously, but at the same time, he hadn't done it himself in the top job on his own, if you know what I mean. So he still had that, I think, to prove to himself. But he brought in fairness to himself, like, he backed himself to, you know, to kind of delegate the training, I suppose, to Gerard McCarthy, who was a real legend of, you know, Cork hurling, to state the obvious. He's there from 66 and a three-in-a-row team in the 70s, and, you know, that generation in 1990, you know, looked up to him big time, and then he was a great innovative trainer, I suppose, and he had the lads doing you know, laps of the tunnel kind of in Parky Queeve and kind of hot nights and in that, you know, really warm summer, and it was just a great combination that kind of I suppose complemented each other.
Like. I know I said we were going to talk about the footballers, now we've got stuck into the hurling thing, but it's hard not to, and you know, the falling out with Justin McCarthy because of what was written in the book or whatever, but he seems like a man who could you know, someone who's as I don't mean to disrespect him to say flighty, but, you know, he was asked in after the hurlers had won. He was asked in to say mass for the footballers on the eve of the football final, and Billy Morgan had said all he could say, and he just wanted it to be, you know, straightforward. And he does a 15-minute thing.
Yeah,
and
he did. Yeah, he took but the then, opportunity.
But,
right.
But then got the huff that he was never asked to do any of the further masses.
Yeah, he was definitely disappointed. I think it's fair to say. Yeah,
brilliant. Was he? Had he left us before you wrote the book?
Yeah, he died a few years ago.
So how did you get his story? Who was it?
Well, I spoke to people around him, basically, as much as I could. There was a lot. He kind of had done a lot of interviews, obviously, over the years, my old English teacher, actually, Tim Horgan, had written a couple of books, which I referenced a lot. But then it was just trying to get a sense of the players, really, and, you know, people who'd faced him, you know, like people like Sir Farrell and Babs Keating, who were contemporaries of his, were happy to...
Who he went off drinking with after they won in Tip.
Yeah, it was Nicky English, yeah. I suppose Nicky English was in those UCC. I think he won 4 in a row of the 10, like as a player. Mm-hmm. So they were, and actually, Father O'Brien married Nicky English and his wife not long before that came. You referenced, yeah. So he was a hero, and like the players still, you know, they won't hear a bad word said against him. He was amazing man.
Right. We did delve into the hurling side of things, and actually, you know, as you say all of that, and we say it, and there's me saying the football was the more interesting side of it. And you're listening. There's just some of the stories involved in the hurling side of it, which is as interesting as anything. Hurling does shine brighter than football in Cork, and Kerry had such a strong side, dominating right through the 80s. More or less right through the 80s, up until the end of the 80s anyway, and Mick O'Dwyer at the helm. How were Cork going to come in and try to... Because I think wasn't there a story that they stole one of the matches along the way?
Yeah, I think they were... Kerry put together 4 in a row, then lost one, then put another 4 in a row together, whatever it was. So they were off the back of 4
and
in a row.
And that's all Ireland's?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So,
never mind Munster.
Yeah, Cork won in 83, I suppose, in Munster, and they got out of it. Yeah, but otherwise, yeah, it was, you know, a lot of hard luck stories, really. And there was generations of Cork players that never really had any success against Kerry. Then I suppose Billy Morgan came in late 86, and he had the kind of imprimatur of beating Kerry and winning an All Ireland in 73. And he's a born winner. He'd done it with Nemo, the college. You know, he'd gone to New York and kind of studied modern training techniques. So he came in, and it was, you know, when I was writing the book, it felt like a heist movie, the way he'd kind of blended new talent from under 21s, asked some old timers like Danny Allen back for one last job. You know, he got people like Dave Barry to, you know, he got him to kind of mix the soccer
with Guy Ritchie in to do the lock, stock and two smoking barrels. We're going to get the team back together. but you're right, it was about getting characters back into the team. Do you think he was... Did he know the holes he needed to fill, or was it just he could see who was out there and say, if I can get them back? Because, you know, Dave Barry's one.
And there was Dinny Allen, who he'd know well, I suppose. Obviously, he knew Dinny Allen well from playing with him. But he was still getting picked for, Railway Cup games for Munster, even though he wasn't playing for Cork. He was a serious player, even though he was in his late 30s at that stage. And then there was probably a bit of opportunism in that he basically convinced Larry Tompkins and Shea Fahey to join. So Shea Fahey was a soldier.
But that was the West Cork connection that they had from New York, I think, to a degree, wasn't it?
That was Larry, he was in New York, and he'd been working with a couple of brothers from Castlehaven, and when he came home, he was playing with the club. He actually played his first Cork game before he played a game for Castlehaven, and as it turned out,
and married a girl from there, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so he ultimately was Cork captain in 1990 because Castlehaven won in 89. So he was a huge addition in that. He was probably one of those holes that was needed, and he was a free taker. And then Shea Fahey was from Kildare as well, but it was probably a bit more organic in that he was a soldier stationed in Cork, and he just got fed up with
the travelling.
Then you have two massive players there, especially when you go up against Meath, and they have that kind of track record of playing against them.
And that's what drove the Meath, whatever about the players, but the fans mad. They really hated that. And it just seemed, I suppose, more so even then, against the GAA traditions.
Yeah, completely. And the vitriol was massive. There was one particular game, I think it was the league semi-final up in Croke Park, and it was a bitter rivalry, and this game was particularly a standout for the hits and the off-the-ball stuff. And Larry Tompkins recalls, and Billy was mentioning it to me as well, you know, the abuse that they took from the Meath fans afterwards. They kind of hung around waiting because they wanted to kind of let them know that this perceived... you know, as you say, kind of breaking of the unwritten rules was anathema to them. But Cork fans completely accepted those players straight away. They proved that they were completely committed to the jersey, and, you know, they're Cork legends now.
Seemingly Larry Tompkins was a serious operator training wise, and brought standards on.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fair to say. He was, I think probably at that stage he was obsessed with his own game, really, and he just spent so much time training, as you say, and perfecting the various skills, particularly free taking. I think later on probably he became more of a a leader for the whole panel, really. Like, but I suppose it's natural that he was at that stage focused on himself. But yeah, he did insane stuff. Like the fitness levels were off the charts. Like there was one particular episode. He was injured, and he Frank Murphy, I think, or the Cork County Board anyway, got him off to Old Trafford, and the Cliff in Manchester, and the Alex Ferguson and the United staff took care of him, and I think they were even impressed with the standard of fitness. Was just incredible from an amateur player.
So they've and actually you do link it in the book to that about knocking them off their effing perch in the Alex Ferguson quote re-Cork and Kerry.
Yeah.
So how was that plotted? So Shea Fahey's brought back in, Larry Tompkins, Dinny Allen, Dave Barry not yet at that point. That's as a result of him and his individual spirit of why can't I play football both sides of both codes.
Yeah, exactly. So I think both Dinny Allen and Dave Barry missed out on 87. Cork ultimately lost kind of fair and square, you know, relatively speaking, in that final, but then they came back.
You're talking me. Yeah, but I want to bring you
Kerry. So yeah, Kerry were top dogs, obviously. Like Billy probably poured every kind of bit of preparation into beating them, and ultimately down the park, Mikey Sheehy scored a goal late on, and it felt like the kind of not this again type story. It was like the typical Kerry coming and getting away with it, and then Cork will be, as the narrative had gone, be beaten in Killarney. But in the dressing room,
well, like, because it took them a few years, obviously they lost down, like, how many years did it take Billy to
no, they went straight away ultimately. So he came in late 86 and 87, they drew the first game in the park, and then they went down
and
to
that
Killarney.
Goal you're referring to is like this ghost goal that no one knows how it managed to win. They'd beaten them off the park, and then out of nowhere there's a stolen draw. But maybe I'm stealing your story, am I?
Well, I think you're right in that. Like,
it was the trip down to Killarney that galvanised the team.
I think they needed it. And the players would have taught me that. They needed to kind of almost have that kind of gauntlet. But even at, 10 minutes after that goal went in, they were in the dressing room and kind of hyping themselves up and hopping a ball off each other and saying, we're going to go to Killarney and finish this job, which was, in fairness, probably a change from what it was in the past. And it was them that kind of picked Billy Morgan up, really. And they didn't do much that week, really, I don't think. And then they just went down there and absolutely demolished Kerry, really, relatively speaking. Like, and that was a huge day, really, when you consider the rest of the 4-year journey or 5-year, whatever way you put it.
And do you think Billy Morgan went into the Kerry dressing room and congratulated the second best team in the country?
Yeah, I'm sure he took the opportunity, right, to kind of...
Because isn't that the famous Mick O'Dwyer line?
Yeah, so over the years, Mick O'Dwyer would have come in and kind of... I suppose patronised Cork, really, by kind of saying you're the best, or the second best rather, team in the country, and it kind of demeaned Dublin as well, who were kind of their main rivals at the time. The Cork team definitely took the opportunity to enjoy the day, like Billy Morgan famously said, even though he told me he didn't necessarily say this, fuck the bus, and they walked down to Killarney Town, and they had, obviously a good night, and they went back to Macroom and then back to Town. Like, although a few of them ended up in the Dingle Peninsula as well. Like,
drinking with Paddy O'Shea.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so that was a famous night, and they were up and running, and that was them, like, convinced.
But did it, like, it's, you mentioned Babs Keating and Nicky English and the Cannon, and the connections between all of these bitter rivals is interesting too. Who is it married into Kerry aristocracy? Football aristocracy.
Colm O'Neill, who was one of the heroes of 90, although he was ultimately sent off in the final, but he kicked 11 points in the Munster final against Kerry in 1990. Yeah, he married Maurice Fitzgerald's sister, and whose father as well as Ned Fitzgerald, who would be he's a good footballer, to say the least, in his own right. Like, so,
has a number of Celtic crosses in the back pocket, as a reference in the book. And got bad advice, though, one day, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose Colm O'Neill would be known as, like, an excellent player, strong man, great footballer, but he wouldn't have been the one you'd put top of the queue for fighting fellas. But Ned O'Sullivan, as Colm told me one night, he said, a fella comes at you, just drag him down and you won't get sent off. You'll just get a ticking off maybe from the referee. So he did that. And he was sent off for that. Fast forward to 1990, and I think Mick Lyons was giving him a lot of it, and he just retaliated. He was the top of the queue at that stage, and he was the one who was sent off. But great player.
But not in his defence, but Mick Lyons subsequently said that despite it only being something like 24 minutes, he said he's never had a harder time, and he was busted for, like, he was broke for the game after, even though he was the free man, he did nothing.
Yeah, he was pretty I suppose, invisible afterwards for whatever reason. And that's probably on Sean Boylan as well, to be honest. He should have made a switch there. Like, but yeah, you're right. Like, Cullen O'Neill cracked the crossbar. He scored a point, I think. He had him run ragged. Like, and I don't know, was he just psyched up or whatever? He was kind of sick in the build-up to that with the virus, he says. And he was pretty quiet.
Silent on the train journey up. Never spoke a word.
But people, like, you can imagine, like, you're on the road for 4 years, like, and this is the kind of the big bad monster, and you want to get over them, and you're just wired, and everybody is talking each other up.
To be honest with you, to your credit, Adrian, I honestly did get a sense in reading it. I've not been anywhere close to anything like that, you know what I mean? Yeah. But I was able to kind of a little bit feel in the minds of the players on the night, you know, and all of that build up and all that tension and that whole story. You're just kind of thinking, like, whoa. It must be very intense. One of the players, I think, spoke about being very nervous until the lad that came in from the States.
Yeah, Danny Cullity. Yeah, he was another one who was kind of part of that heist movie, first act, like, where Billy kind of plucked him. He was he grew up in San Francisco from kind of a Cork, North Cork family, and he ended up back in North Cork, and he was playing football at a certain level, and he eventually went up to under 21 and he got his shot. He was probably on the bench around 89, but he started in midfield, I think, in 1990 for the Footballers then, and he had a great game. Like, Shafai got 4 points, but it was Danny Cullity as well who was kind of feeding him the ball and winning those high
his fielding battles. Seemed to be the thing, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that was it. He was.
But he spoke about being, bricking it. Like, this was, he dreamt of this in the back over in the States.
Yeah.
And here he was going out behind the Artane Boys band, but that the roar of the Cork crowd settled it all, and he was almost like, okay, here we go.
Yeah, which is what you want, isn't it? I suppose, like, he was, as you say, you set the scene well. He was kind of walking behind the band, and you can almost imagine walking behind your teammates and the colour, and
well, you could go one or two ways.
Yeah, that's it. Like, yeah, he said he's heard the roar from the Cork Road, I think it was on the hill, and it was just like a trigger, and the nerves just fell out of him, and he was like, okay, let's go. I suppose, you know what, if you have the preparation done, it's easy for me to say, but you'd imagine if you have the work done and you kind of feel, look, I'm surrounded by guys who are going to back me up here, and I think, like, Larry Tompkins now again, he said, and Mick Sloka maybe taught me that, it was the most focused group of people ever. Like, they were just kind of not going to lose that game. It was just a psychological thing almost. So, like, then they went out and had to do it, obviously, and they had to do it with 14 men.
The white heat of battle. I mean, it just, it would be bollock tightening.
Yes, yeah, I can't imagine it.
Jesus. I mean, that's why the stories are so engaging, I guess, is because there is all that history, there's the tradition, there's the colours, there's the fans, there's the in, the out, the media, and it all comes down to walking out on a pitch and actually having to do it.
And then the added pressure, I suppose, on the footballers was
that's probably the fun time, though, I suppose.
Yeah, you get to black it up, and because they were, you can imagine the hype, like, either that fortnight between this date, let's say, as we're recording, and a fortnight's time, the city, I kind of remember as a kid, it was bananas, like, and you can imagine the footballers trying to insulate themselves from that hype and just get the job done against their arch rivals. So it was almost a blessing that they could just focus on these guys that they didn't like, really.
The sunny summer of 1990 when the Prince played in the park, which was to the chagrin of many around the city, and the sun shone, and Cork won all round them in almost everything from Neptune to the only fly in the ointment was Dundalk winning in Turner's Cross in 91, the end of that season. But
Tom McNulty goal, and I remember that well. Neptune did a double, as you say. Yeah, there was various victories, and
it was Cork's summer, 1990, no question about that. The bus one I love because it was something like they'd beaten Kerry in Killarney. They'd gotten the they were over the hoodoo, and they were saying, "Oh, we have to hang on for the bus. Fuck the bus, we'll walk into town."
Yeah.
And you can almost imagine, man, and seemingly there's some story of Dutch tourists or something, is there?
Yeah, the Dutch, it was great kind of as a project, just getting into the nitty gritty of this place and time, and these little stories kind of make themselves known to you. So, like, there was some Dutch tourists outside Max Sweeney's bar there, and they asked the guard, like, is this a festival or something? No, it's the match. Like, and you can imagine the Cork players with their blazers over their shoulders walking down the hill into the town, like, and just kind of enjoying a good day's work, really, and the relief of it. And the Cork, you can imagine, from my point of view, imagine that day as a Cork supporter, like, after so many years of heartache, whatever, down there and just going for the day trip.
But, like, Cork fans be magnanimous.
Well, there's examples of that throughout the book, all right, like, but that, yeah, you can imagine there wasn't. You don't have to ask him too much to kind of take the piss a bit, all right, like, I'm sure, but sounds like a great day in Killarney.
And, like, you can imagine what the scenes would be like now, but in 1990 it feels like it would have been a wilder, like, Ireland was a very different place back then.
It's true. Yeah, it was. It did feel that. And that came across in you know, the kind of, you mentioned Prince and stuff, like, and it was a different country, wasn't it? Like, all the kind of controversy around, like, the perceived sexual on Parky Creeve and the Hallow Turf there. And then it was Italian 90 was wrapped up with it as well. And it was like an innocent summer. Like.
The new, there's so many great lines in this, in the book. Who was the new county chairman? Was he Dennis Conroy?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what? It took Cork 100 years to do this.
It took Conroy two months
or something. But he was sort of a bit of a dyed in the wool. You know, like, what did you describe in the book as?
He was a traditionalist.
Ban era.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Like, he was a traditionalist, definitely, and the real kind of, you know, Cork County Board's man. Like, so yeah, there was like various.
Ireland was in transition at that time, and it was still very firmly in the more traditional conservative side of things. Although change was coming, and seeing Billy Morgan out and the boys playing football, soccer,
Like, so Billy threw in a soccer ball,
and then it was ole ole chants,
and there was like Nessun Dorman with the Airtime band or whatever, like, and. Dennis Conroy said he was going to ask Prince about the content of the show and stuff, you know. So, yeah, these
the Lord Mayor wouldn't go up to meet him.
No, Chrissy Horn, I think, wasn't it? Yeah, she was offended on, which is fair enough, on behalf of the Children of Cork or whatever. And Joe Duffy set up a soapbox on Princess Street and was kind of
he was ball
winding
hopping.
People up, big time, So, yeah, it was a mad time, like,
So we're hopping all over the place. Look, lads, the story is in the book in more coherent fashion than perhaps the conversation, but so. Fuck the bus. They're down in Killarney, and we alluded to it already. The big horizon was Kerry, and it's understandable, but there was a further horizon to come that maybe maybe it was the psychologically they weren't ready for that next step, having overcome such a big one.
I think so. Yeah. Well, I wasn't there, but various players say that was probably the case, that they were just so focused, and maybe it was subconscious as much as anything with that. They were happy with beating Kerry, and that was an achievement in itself. Like, and then they hadn't faced them before, and Meath, in fairness, were probably a year down the track ahead of them. Like, they had lost to Kerry in the final the year before that, so they'd kind of, you know, they'd lost their one to win one, if you know what I mean. So they were beaten, fair enough, then, and then, but 88 is when the whole relationship, if you want me to skip on to that, turned toxic, really.
In the league game?
Yeah.
Or was it even before that?
No, it would have been when they got to the final.
So let's make it clear to people anyway. So Cork have overcome Kerry. They've lost to Meath in the first of four All-Ireland football finals. Yeah.
And then in 88, they managed to beat Kerry straightforwardly enough, I suppose. Kerry are kind of busted flush at that stage, really. That era is over.
Was that the season of the January friendly down in... Is that the next year again?
Yeah,
okay,
probably,
we'll get to that. Yeah. That was a fun one. I enjoyed that aspect of it.
So then they get back basically by hook or by crook anyway to the final, and it's Meath again. And this is kind of where it goes toxic.
They left it behind them.
Yeah, so they play really well, and then ultimately they're reeled in, and they miss a great goal chance, and they're reeled in. And but then, like, Larry Tompkins puts over a late free, which, you know, Dave Barry thinks is the last kick of the game, because he says told by the referee that it is. He jumps on Larry Tompkins' back, then the ball goes out for a sideline ball that Cork players think it should go the other way. The ball is played in, David Beggy, the Meath forward, former rugby player, goes to ground, and there's a
barely touched,
there's a 14 metre free in. Cork players are,
it's, and it's a Kerry ref,
Tommy Sugar, who kindly spoke to me as well from Tralee, Blennerville. He says, still, it's a free, like, every player, and, you know.
Yeah, his explanation of it after, when he went through the various incidents, he gave a good defence of himself, in fairness.
I think the line, you know,
there was a lot of bad blood over how Meath came back to win it.
Yeah, so, like, in the intervening fortnight, so it's a replay, basically. Then in the intervening fortnight, Billy Morgan probably tells his team to kind of, let's play ball, and at the same time Sean Boylan and the Meath players are deciding we're going to go up a level, and the next game is a bloodbath by all accounts. Well, I've watched it, and it is a tough game.
But seemingly the GAA president
Yeah.
In his opening speech to them.
Yeah, John Dowling, he was horrified by it. Like, the, you can imagine the newspapers, like in those days, the players, both sets of players met the next day in Mainham Jail for a luncheon type thing, and doesn't happen anymore. So the GA president made a speech, and, you know, usually this is very obviously pleasant and all the rest of it, but he kind of made clear that he was appalled and embarrassed by what went on the day before, and yeah, Mead players were offended by that. Cork players weren't, didn't want to be there anyway, they just wanted to get the train home, and you know, there was just a lot of bad blood then kind of happening or developing, I suppose, the war between the two panels at that stage. So it went from a normal rivalry, I think, to probably going up a few levels, and that like, there was various incidents then afterwards with the, you know, the following year, I think probably they're both staying in the same hotel in the Playa de Inglés. And
that's right. How does that happen?
I know.
So they both panels went on holidays and both landed in the same hotel at the same time.
Yeah, and they just decided, consciously or not to talk to each other. Like, various players know, like Liam Hayes and Larry Tompkins said they did speak. I think Billy Morgan had a drink and a chat with one of the players, the Mead players, at one stage. But generally speaking, if you went into a lift and there was a Mead player, next day you just looked at the ceiling, was how it put to me, or like if they were in the deep end, we were in the shallow end or whatever. Yeah. Like, it seems silly, you know, but they really didn't like each other, I suppose.
You need that for a proper rivalry,
yeah,
though,
yeah,
don't you?
Definitely, like, absolutely. And you know, it's different times as well. There wasn't, like, lads know these days, players are like in university together, or they're on social media, you know, on each other's Instagrams, put it that way. There's a lot more contact, but these guys didn't know each other really. Like, you know, Larry Tompkins did, and Shefa, he knew a few of them. But generally, they were strangers and they just didn't like the way they played ball. And then there was that league game. League semi-final later on, where it was just vicious stuff, and
in fairness, like, Meath have probably the worst reputation, do they, for
yeah, like when I was young they were like the boogeyman type thing, weren't they? Like, I mean, it was like, if you don't do your homework, fucking
Meath will get you
whatever, like, yeah. Brilliant. So like,
but that, so they've lost two finals in a row to Meath, and left one behind them, were robbed out of it as it's seen, and then beaten out of it in the replay. I just like that Kerry story of, so they brought back a few, because the, you know, having banished the hoodoo, you know, and the story on Kerry is that they'd not replaced their legendary team. That, you know, they were so strong for so long that they hadn't blooded new players in. So when it broke, it was very hard to fix it. There was nothing coming through.
Yeah, exactly. You can imagine that always happens, doesn't it? Like, although Kilkenny have managed to avoid it over the years, it's hard to tell Paddy O'Shea or Pat Spillane, you're not playing this year, and we're going to bring through a young guy and give him a chance. So like, and at the same time, they were winning All Irelands, even though they were probably regressing a little bit over the years, but they were still putting wins together. So it's hard for Mick O'Dwyer, as it was at the time, to change things. And Mickey Nettle Sullivan, who ultimately succeeded him, did warn him at one stage, like, this is going to be, you know, hard for the next man, which he was ultimately.
And seemingly, he
Mickey,
said,
like, I don't care about the next man or whatever.
That's for the next man to worry about.
Yeah, so. So,
although,
yeah,
exactly, you know, I think your legacy as a manager is not just what you've done, but also how you've handed it on. I think, well, yeah, what do I know? But look, that's what this looks like from the from the outside. But so 88 they lose again, and then 89 they bring a few of the old heads back in, and they do it. There's a challenge match down in Castletown Bear.
Yeah,
and Kerry land off the bus.
Yeah, as Larry remembers it. Yeah, like Kerry had earmarked this as like, okay, we're going to put down a marker on Mick O'Dwyer. Wanted to win this one, even though it was just an opening of a pitch, I think, below in, as you say, Castletown Bear, was it? So, like, but like, as Larry Tompkins remembers it, and I should say, actually, Dennis Hurley and Larry Tompkins have a new book out, and I'm sure there's a lot more detail on a lot of these stories, and it'd be great to read and looking forward to it. So, yeah, Larry kind of hopped up on the table and kind of warned, I think he got word that this was something that the Kerry lads were earmarking as a win, and they were going to set down a marker this year. Like, so it was played basically like a Munster final in front of a small crowd in a small little pitch or whatever, like, and they went hammer and tongs, and Cork beat them off the pitch, and he thinks that's the day that maybe Kerry were put in their box once and for all, like, and they'd kind of overcome them. Like,
that's why I wanted to get that story out, because even as a blow into Cork, I find that pleasurable to hear. okay, and that's 89.
So yeah, coming into 89 now, then,
the league semi final, like me, it's a bloodbath again.
The league semi final was 90, actually. So, Billy Morgan got down his hands, got down his knees, and said, "I hope we meet them in the final," which they did. So in 89, Dublin beat Meath actually in the Leinster final, so they didn't even get out of Leinster as it happens.
Okay,
and Mayo came through, and they were.
And that was Mayo's first. Oh, listen, tell the story about O'Connell Street and the Cork fans. We all know the story of Mayo still haven't won one since 57. And this was the first time they were back in since then, or whatever the year is.
So, Cork hadn't won one since 73, I suppose, is it? But they'd been at least around the place since 87, 88. Some Cork fan approached a group of Mayo lads and said, are you looking for Nelson's pillar or whatever? They blew him up in whatever year. It was
66.
They were on a wind up, weren't they? But Mayo were a great team. Like, they were kind of unlucky. Mick Slocum made a point that they were kind of probably built up by Cork to be bigger than they were, because Cork losing another one, that would be three in the trot, obviously, and that would be kind of game
psychologically
over.
Psychologically, hard to come back from that.
Yeah, and Billy, Morgan says himself he'd be gone probably if that was staged, and a lot of players probably would have went to that stage. So the whole thing was on the line, really, even though it wasn't me. The whole kind of group knew that this was really, really important. And there was a lot of nerves, at the same time, probably those guys are winding up the lads outside a pub on O'Connell Street to kick Ronan, decided that, as he was wont to do, they need settling down here. So he sang the banks or whatever, going up O'Connell Street and settled everybody down. And, Cork were in control for a while, but they nearly let it slip, I suppose. There was a couple of goal chances for Mayo, and they got away with it at that stage, and then they kicked on again, and they were a better team, really, in truth. But a lot of the players would say that, it was a massive, obviously, an all-around win, but they hadn't beaten Mead along the way, it was still that monkey on the back.
Well, okay, so we've three All-Ireland football finals. Cork have lost two on the bounce to Meath. They've won against Mayo, having nearly let it slip, but finally the monkey's off the back in that regard. Let's pause that story now, because it's the footballers complete the double. So before we get to the 1990 part of it please Lord, let it be Meath, which is brilliant. Let's go back to the hurlers, so and build back up a bit. We've talked a bit about the cannon, but let's happily talk a bit more and how himself and Gerald McCarthy were a great mix as a management team. But you opened the book with a story of a character I didn't know about, and you referenced him there, the Kid Cronin. That's a brilliant backstory there too, isn't it?
Yeah, he was someone who was really interested in. I'm from that neck of the woods myself, so I'd been aware of him as a kid myself. And then it was just when I interviewed every player, it was just a question to kind of start off it, because I was, it was a fun question, and you talk about the Kid, and then I kind of realised, there's something bigger here, and he's a massive part of this story.
He's like the special sauce of both teams.
Yeah, I hope that comes across. He kind of pulled everything together a little bit. He was, if people don't remember, he was a masseuse. He was a professional boxer in his youth. He went to England and he fought in what were called the boods. So basically travelling circuses for boxers, and they'd kind of have a roll-up routine with guys coming from the crowd and fighting for a five or whatever. And then he came back and he was involved in the Glen Boxing Club and the Glen Hurling Club in St Nick's, and then he was brought by Donny O'Donovan in 1973 to the footballers, Cork footballers. So Billy Morgan would have known him, and he was there in the meantime as well with the both sides, so he knew generations of players, and he was beloved, really, and just a very funny man, with a great manner, especially in a dressing room, maybe with somebody like Billy Morgan and Father O'Brien, who were, had to be the way they were, and determined to overcome these barriers, Kerry, Meade, Tipperary, whoever. You kind of need that yin and yang, don't you, I suppose? And he was someone who had a huge knowledge. He kind of knew Christy Ring well, and he kind of traded off that and those stories, especially for the younger players like John Fitzgibbon. And he knew all the kind of, he brought people back down to earth, or he built them up if they had a bad day, and people like Danny Cullity and others who were kind of trying to break into various teams remember kind of acts of kindness and various words of encouragement on the way back, and players like Tomás Mackay and Tony Sullivan used to pick him up outside the Glen Hall, and he'd have a drink with players, and he'd always have a joke in his own ways, so he pulled it together, definitely. And he, as well as that, he was good for a ball hop with the likes of the Cannon and whoever, and kind of a wisecrack here and there, from my point of view, he was a dream,
I'm just looking here now too, on the way to Munster Hurling final against Tip in Park, down the park, Cork bus snaking its way through the rainy streets, O'Brien had adapted a UCC chant, "Who are we? Cork!" and all of this. So this particular day, Sensing aside needed to boost their energy levels. O'Brien stood at the began as, "Who are we?" Cronin, who'd assisted with the Fitzgibbons Cups over the years, sitting in the centre of the back row. UCC! give us the T-shirt story over on over in the Canary Islands, is it?
Yeah, just on that story, that says a lot actually as well, like that, because the whole bus, you know, broke down and laughed or
breaks the tension.
Yeah, but then he knew, like, the cannon probably got a bit odd, maybe, you know, understandably. So then he kind of knew, look, I need to rescue this, and he sang The Banks or whatever he sang after.
Beautiful City.
Beautiful City. And, you know, he got the whole thing going again and kind of focused people, which was what the cannon was trying to do anyway. Like, you know, so he was, I think, without knowing the man, he seemed really emotionally intelligent, and he knew exactly what was needed in various dressing rooms, like having been a corner man in boxing rings, if you know what I mean. So he kind of had that intuition. So then, people talk about, you know, the trips to the States, and there was one trip to the Canaries as well for whatever holiday they had, and he turned up with a "Don't Mess with the Kid Cronin" t-shirt, and he was going around with the handkerchief on the head, whatever, like kind of Grandad Trotter type thing or whatever. So he just, you know, he was a lightning rod for the crack, really, but he was, you know, usually respected and what's the word, valuable, I suppose. Really, he did bring a lot to this camp, like,
you know, there long enough to see the dawn of actual psychologists, or the pathologists, as he,
yeah,
geez lads, I think the pathologists are here again tonight. I know, he's some brilliant stories, and how he barely put the oil on, there'd be no, so yeah. Frank Ho- and but it was, yeah, there's something about that too, about how it was skillfully done.
Yeah, so I suppose at that stage he was an
Frank
old man.
Frank Hogan, like, being brought in, yeah.
Yeah, so Frank Hogan was, you know, part of that 73 football team. He was, I suppose, as well, Billy Morgan's brother-in-law, and a brilliant defensive tactician. So he was brought in. So I suppose Billy Morgan asked him, I think, according to Colman Corrigan, if the kid would essentially just teach Frank basically how to do the massaging. And they did it together then in those years. And then the jokes were that, you know, the kid would just be quoting you at that stage, but he wasn't giving you a proper rub, so you'd be kind of running in circles, or yeah, or one leg would be a lot more powerful, I suppose, than the other afterwards, like if you were getting Frank and kid on either leg.
No, you did a great job with the kid, and it's a great start to the book, that, because it really brings you into the whole kind of thing. And is it Dinny Allen telling the story about the one of the natural comedians of the team, the train journey, when they were playing a game of Hold'em, the kid's playing his custom game of Hold'em?
Yeah, he liked the game of Don in Blackpool, I know, as well, and he often kind of said, I need to get back to Blackpool for a game of 45 or Don or whatever. But yeah, they were playing that day, and I suppose the point that Dinny Allen was making was that he had a very young mind and a great sense of humour, and Dinny told him a joke about whatever the joke was. The punchline was, you know, a Kerry man.
They found this, yeah, a skeleton of a Kerry man
in a false wall or something. Yeah, with a hide and seek champion, 1935. Yeah, and he said literally the kid was laughing for 3 hours to Dublin. He couldn't stop. But that's where he was, I think, in his element, where he was kind of amongst the players, like, and like people like Kieran McGuckin and John Fitzgibbon, Mark Foley, you know, these young players, that, like, a lot of them relied on him, and that word of encouragement went a long way, I suppose, like.
So he's a character. I mean, we've talked a bit about the canon, and by all means, you know, carry on with him, because
yeah, well, he was just a massive part of it, wasn't he? The key, like, really, in a lot of ways, like, he was a hugely charismatic man, you know, a priest from Inishannon, who was then in Carrigaline. He had been in Blackrock before that. You know, just fanatic, really, for hurling. You know, one of these men who just lived for hurling. Huge success with St Finbar's and Fanfares, and then UCC, as we've said, like, and then involved with various Cork underage teams after. He was involved with Cork in 84 in the senior team, and just a massive character, like, kind of, he kind of barked, like, Mark Foley, who would have known him from school all the way up, so 12 all the way up, he would have played with him and been taught by him, really. He kind of makes the point, you know, his bark was a lot worse than his bite or whatever, and he kind of, he did bark at people in this kind of staccato way and kind of gave you instructions and expected you to do what he said. And he had a philosophy in hurling. It was like the pitch was divided up into, you know, in his mind, various grids, and every man had to win their own battle, and that was essential, that you had to kind of, you know, it was almost like a mathematical problem. If 8 of us win our battles, then we'll win the game, basically, like. So but just a massive personality, I suppose.
And he was determined to wake fellas up, seemingly, at halftime.
Yeah, well, yeah, there was a few raw words at halftime, as he said himself, and he did probably more than that as well. He gave one player a dig, I think, is how it was put by various players.
But he was fond of a bucket of...
Yeah, he dragged a few players into the... Like, Cork were bad in that first half, and Joe Cooney had run riot, really, like, and so he dragged a few players into the shower area and threw a bucket of water over them and told them to take off their shirts and all the rest of it. And he was looking for a reaction, like, and he was... you know, it was goes back to that kind of psychology stuff that he was interested in, like, and he just... Then he kind of gathered everyone on in a tight kind of circle, and he held a Cork jersey in his hand, and he, and as various players told me, like, he was crying basically, and he was saying, "Go there and do it for Cork and your families and for me." And Tomás Mackay sticks in my mind. He says that he would have run through a wall at that stage, and the other players are the same. Like, and he said there was something special. Like, you can kind of roll your eyes now at it, and maybe some players were, but like, I think. He definitely had that charisma, and he convinced people to go and win. And they were 5 points on at half time, and it went to seven, so it didn't work immediately. But then Cork did get on top, like, and there was various tactical switches as well. Obviously.
And that's Galway in the final we're talking there.
Yeah.
Because we referenced the Derbies don't win, Donkeys won, because it was tip they had to get over along the way too. And they'd had a poor 89, like, it was not going well for Cork hurling.
No, not at all. It was at a very, very low ebb. Like, Cork had...
Was there something that got done that season at the start of it that changed it, do you think?
Well, they had lost to Waterford in 89, which is, you know, wasn't the Waterford that we would know of. You know, the great tradition they have now, I suppose. Like, so it was a shock. And then the Cannon came in, and then he started building a team then as well, I suppose. Like, Tomás Mackay, John Fitzgibbon, Kevin Hennessy, you know, these big, George Fitzgerald, they hadn't been involved. So he gets them back. He starts, it's almost same as Billy in the, it's a psychological cultural shift, really. It's like reminding them of where they're from. Like, that was part of the license, you know, even though the license play thing is funny, it was like reminding, like, okay, we have 26 All-Irelands here, we have tradition, you know, that Jim Tough Barry, you know,
Like, it had maybe been forgotten or something.
Yeah, it's like, let's get back to basics. They like, Cork,
we are Cork.
Exactly, yeah. Which, you know, Dunlough would have shouted at later on in All-Ireland Finals, we are Cork, and people can sniff at it. But it was like a psychological thing, wasn't it?
Like, that's obviously where it comes from.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I wouldn't have known that.
Yeah, and you know, it was but they came from nowhere. Like, Tipperary were huge favourites for that Munster final. Like, nobody gave outside the county anyway a chance, and even within the county maybe. You know, he just convinced people basically that we have the pedigree, and they did have serious players, like, and then he blended some great young players like Mark Foley, who got 2-7 that day, amazing day. Like, he had he brought John Fitzgibbon back in, who hadn't been there in 89, like, amazingly, like, brilliant player. Then he brought in people like, you know, like Brendan O'Sullivan from Inishannon, you know, kind of, he wouldn't be a classical hurler, but the type of player that he loves, you know, that kind of big hearted and strong and committed, and obviously a good hurler as well, like, but that kind of character he loved. You know, and then you had the remnants of, you know, teams who'd won in 84 and 86. So, like, they weren't mugs. We just needed to kind of be put back together, I suppose, a little bit. And Gerard McCarthy was on the line with him, who was, you know, a great thinker in the game and usually respected. So the elements were there. It's surprising that people didn't kind of expect a bit of an ambush, really, against Tip. Like, but they had an amazing day, like, and... like, the Silver Fox does it again was the line from Nicky English. And as he was walking off the field, he kind of knew that the Cannons' fingerprints were all over this win, like...
Yeah, that was Antrim. Then was what lay await in the semis, and seemingly Cork fans barely travelled for it.
Yeah,
it was a formality.
Yeah, like, and which is probably unfair because, like, Antrim had shocked awfully, I think, the year before that to get the All-Ireland final against Tip, and they were well beaten then, I suppose. But they were a good team, like, Cork got the job done basically. Like, I think it was business like. There was a bit to work on probably. It was good for some of the younger players to kind of get a look at. Croke Park, like, Mark Foley missed it, I think, because he was injured, so he had to watch from the sidelines. But, like, otherwise, the rest of the team got a bit of a run out at Croke Park, which is less, or was less frequent in those days with the backdoor stuff. Like, so, but then it was Galway up, who were like the team of the 80s, really. And if they had won this game, they could rightly say they were the team of, you know, the era, I suppose. Like, I think they were going for, I don't know, 3-4, 3-5 All-Irelands or something like that, whatever. Well, they've lost a couple as well. Like.
Yeah, I got brought to an All-Ireland when I don't want to be revealing my age, but anyway, I was 12 at the time, I think, and it was, I think it was 86, Galway, Offaly, and whoever we got the tickets from was Galway Connection, so we were supporting Galway in the day, and Offaly won that one.
Yeah.
So that was 86. So then
as well, like, and they'd won a couple, like, and They probably felt that they were robbed in 89 with the Tony Keady thing, and they lost the tip in the semi-final or whatever. So,
what was the Tony Keady thing?
He got suspended because he played in America. You know, some technicality and a perceived injustice for Galway, basically, but a massive controversy, I suppose, for them. And
so they'd lost in 89 as well?
Yeah, they'd lost the semi-final in 89. But, like, if they got through that, they would have played Antrim. So it was, like, the de facto final, by some was like, we respect Antrim. Yeah. They'd won, you know, a couple, 87 and 88, maybe.
So they lost two in a row when Cork beat them.
Yeah. Is that right? Yeah. Well, they lost the semi-final in 89, then they lost the final in 90. They had won in 88. They'd probably won in 85. So they were a serious team, like, and they had a lot more pedigree than Cork at that stage. And then, in the first half, Joe Cooney just ripped into him. Like although Kevin Hennessy scored the fastest goal, which is still the fastest goal.
Oh, yeah, that's a great story. I told that on air this evening now, actually. Because I was doing numbers around it all, and then I finished with, and 48 is the number of seconds it took. but what's the story, he says?
Yeah, he says he sits down each year still and with a stopwatch.
Because it was the record. It's the fastest ever goal.
Like the ball came into him and he just ripped it home after 48 seconds, whatever it was. And he says he still sits down every year, and then he turns to his family and says, well, I still have the record.
Still have it? So
even though Cork went ahead, that, like, they were kind of... I don't know, overawed maybe is wrong, but I don't know. It was passing them by a little bit anyway. And they were 5 points down at half time, even though it could have been a lot more. Like, there could have been a few goals from Nolan in particular, I think. So then, the Cannon, and they got a hold of them. But then at the same time, I mean, like, it wasn't all fire and brimstone. There was changes there. Like, Gerard Cunningham had a chat with his defence, and they changed up the way the half forwards were kind of receiving the ball. And that paid dividends. Like, they were, like, the half back line took over in the second half, and that was the platform, I think, for the win, really. They started dropping, but, like, Cork ended up with 5 goals. Like, John Fitzgibbon scored 2, Mark Foley got an all Ireland final goal after a brilliant season, Kevin Hennessy, you know. So, like that team, I think one of the reasons they're loved is obviously the double stuff, like, they, you know, they have that historic place, but as well as that, the way they played was just so brilliant. Like, that second half was amazing to watch back. They just took goals wherever they could. Like, they were bloodthirsty, really.
5-15, wasn't it?
Yeah, crazy stuff. Like, and they needed every one of them. They won by, I think, 3 points in the end, but they needed all those goals. Like, as you know, I think Kevin Hennessy makes that point. Like, it wasn't just for show. Like, they needed goals and they got them. Like, and like, they were just such a stylish, fast team, you know, in kind of the Cork tradition, I'd like to think. Yeah, it was amazing. It was a thrilling victory, really. Like, I mean, and Sarah Farr was, you know, particularly when I spoke to him, I suppose gracious is the word afterwards.
Generous.
Like, yeah, they have probably cause for complaint with the steps that John Fitzgibbon for one of the
yes, but goals. they were like, saying the referee was almost so enamoured with style.
Yeah, and he was such a stylish player.
Who did you say that was? Fitzgibbon, no?
Yeah, John Fitzgibbon. Yeah,
yeah, he, actually, I like the cameo he plays or has in the book, or at least the focus that you put on him, the enigma that is Fitzy.
Is that what I call it? Yeah, he was an amazing player. Like, he was probably my favourite player that time. A Glen Rovers player, like, just a really stylish full forward or corner forward with Cork. He just loved scoring goals. He loved Christy Ring. He hated Tipperary. You know, he hated Kilkenny. He was a real kind of laconic, if that's the right word, funny, sharp kind of north side guy, you know. And he loved the ball hop with Kevin Hennessy and the Cannon, and just a brilliant player. Like, he had no interest in playing against Kerry and Waterford or these players, and the players will laugh at times that he asked Charlie Aughey who he was.
Oh no, yeah, that's it. No, I'll get to, you know what, we'll give you a bit of the book, because Tomás Mulcahy, of his big brother role with Fitzgibbon, we'd go to training and we'd have a pint, Patrick Skee and Isaac Bells, I remember that pub well. I'd go into the house and his father would be there, and Christy Ring Jr., son of the hurling legend, his brother Kieran, and the history of hurling and the way they talk about it, and they go back to the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, you knew there was something special about them as a family, about John and Kieran and his father Vince. You could feel hurling in the air when he walked into the place. He could sense it, former Cork goalkeeper Donald Cusack remembers. When he walked into Thurles, for instance, he could feel hurling. When he walked into Cloyne, he could feel it. Hurling leaves something in the air. Only Donald could say something like that. But the bit about him being cool as a cucumber and the Charlie Haughey story is that, and him turning up like Eric Cantona.
Yeah, he was one of those players. He did what he wanted. You know, he wasn't one.
All Stars Banquet, t shirt and jeans.
Yeah, he was, I think, pressed into a tuxedo.
Folded into a tuxedo. you have it.
Really?
And he was then named at left full forward, joining five other Cork players, awarded his piece of glass by then Taoiseach Charlie.
Yeah, I think Charlie was momentarily distracted as he handed over the piece of glass, as you say, and he missed John's
and who are
name.
You?
Ask who are you? You can imagine it, yeah. And
John Fitzgibbon from Cork.
Yeah, who are you? Yeah, but I suppose that sums up. He had no respect for airs and graces, you know. Like he was brilliant. Yeah, what a player! Like, and he was kind of.
I'd say Charlie loved that.
Yeah,
who are you? I gotta have you taken out. Ah, brilliant! But that's the thing that comes out of the book is just all of the characters, and you tell the story really well. So where are we now? Let me see. We pretty much have the hurling done.
Galway tip, yeah.
So
then the pressure is on the footballers, I suppose.
Yeah, so actually, let's get a bit of that. Yeah, so in the actually, Tomás Mulcahy, the speech of his life.
Yeah, so Tomás, amazing win. The cannon is getting.
And references it.
Yeah, so Tomás Mulcahy makes it up, Hogan steps, despite the pandemonium, and he makes a speech and he says, yeah, we'll be back here in a fortnight to complete the double, which I think he immediately thought, oh, I've put pressure on the footballers here, but it went down obviously really, really well with the Cork fans. and Billy Morgan was sat in the Hogan stand, and some unnamed fan kind of climbed up the steps as he was leaving and tapped Billy on the shoulder and said, it's down to you now. And it really was as the rest of the county kind of went into party mode for a fortnight, the footballers had to kind of get back into their bubble, apart from Teddy McCarthy, who we should say played a massive role in the hurlers' win that day, even though he was in and out because of injuries all year, but he was there on the field that day. He had to kind of get his head together after the celebrations and get back into that bubble with the footballers and prepare for Meath. On the night of the homecoming then for the hurlers, the footballers were playing Kerry and demolished them in a challenge game, and it was like, okay, game on here, we need to dial it in for Meath. So I think the pressure, and as Niall Callahan says, the pressure was absolutely piled on them, but at least they had that focus in beating Meath. It wasn't about kind of the double, you know, you hear sports psychologists say, like, you know, concentrate on the actual process. Yeah.
In a way, they were like, we know the double's big, but for us,
yeah, let's just win this
Meath
game
is almost
Meath.
Bigger.
Exactly, yeah, they had to do it, like, and so there was huge pressure in that way anyway, like, so then the county was just hyped up big time, like the ticket prices went through the roof, like people were booking, you know, the days you could get flights from Cork Airport to Dublin, they were booked up, you can imagine the planning that went into it, so it was party time.
I'm just looking back at some of the stories because there was some great, like the cannon and the interviews after the hurling. I know I've jumped back now again. I'm like, this is like what I'm like on air. Should be keeping a linear fashion. Yeah. Let's go forward direction. But I can't, because I know there's like, what was it about the cannon? Was he coming back?
The stuff about like they're after slapping the back off me out there, and this is the man for the Pope.
Yeah.
He made it back to the dressing room, and Jim Kearney interviewed him live. The RT decided to go live, and.
Thank you, Jim Kearney.
Thank you, Jim Kearney. Yeah, he was kind enough to speak to me as well in the cannon. Congratulated him on a good game. He was from Galway, Jim Kearney, obviously. And Gerard McCarthy congratulated him and told him he'd be the next Pope. he kind of admitted that there was a few raw words at halftime, but there was five players, like famously at halftime as well. I don't know if this is myth or not, even after all my research. But at halftime, the cannon apparently said there's only five of you playing out there, or whatever it was, or there's only 12 of you playing out there.
Oh, that's right. What was the one? There was only two of you playing in that half, and one of the lads. Who...
Yeah, so it was. I think the cannon said there's only three out there playing, or whatever it was. And Kevin Hennessy said, "Father, who are the other two?" Like,
on the way out of the dressing room, not even like straight away after.
So that broke the tension as well, I suppose.
Nicky English praising former teacher Michael Lister's poem. 13-year-old Cork supporter from Coolay. Roses are red, the Cork jersey is too. Cork's just beaten Galway and they'll beat Meath too.
Yeah.
Right, I've absolutely jumped back and I'm sorry about that, but I just knew there was loads of little vignettes of stories. The bus on the way back and they spot a fella wearing a red and white jersey locked.
Yeah.
Coming a lift.
There was a lot of that carry on. Yeah, the fan stories are almost as enjoyable to me, like, I suppose, as someone who knows well what it's like. So I think there was a bus heading back towards Ballyfihan with a lot of lads from the south side, and they spotted a guy up by the red coat somewhere in a red top, and he was tumbling a lift, so they let him on and he fell asleep right behind the driver, I think, and conked it, and they woke him up. you know, out in Vickers Road or somewhere at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, we're back in Cork. And your mum was like, oh, I need to be in work at 8 o'clock in Kildare.
Nice. So, Kevin Hennessy, we've mentioned a bit of a wag, spotted the Galway goalkeeper. Hey, give me five.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a good man for the kind of wind ups, I think.
Yeah. No. Plenty of great stories. So, right now, I did bollocks up the whole flow of the thing, but I don't care because there's just so many great stories in here. So the pressure's on. And what do they do? Do they knuckle down? Do they kind of go to ground for the 2 weeks?
Yeah, it was like, they were in Páirc Uí Chaoimh, but it was very much their own bubble. These guys are working as well, though. You know, they couldn't insulate themselves completely. Like, you know, Teddy McCarthy was coming from shifts in Beamish and Crawford, for example. You know, they knew the hype was there, but I suppose from a psychology point of view, they were able to just say, okay, this is about, and this was the point I think that Billy Morgan made, like, this is about beating Meath and this is how we'll do it, like, you know, from a tactical point of view. And then, you know, put the double out of your mind and that will obviously follow if we beat Meath. Like,
look after itself, as they say. It was a classic. The hurling final was a classic game.
Yes.
Would the football final have been described as a classic game?
No, I think not. It was a dogfight, really, as a lot of these games between the two teams were at that stage, and it was probably but it wasn't the worst game either of those. Like, if at the same time, like as I say, Cork had hit the crossbar through Cullum O'Neill in the early stages. They was kind of tit for tat with the points, and then Cullum O'Neill was, and they were cruising, really. Michael Slocum makes
that's
the points.
Right. Yeah. No, they were, yeah, they seemingly were, yeah,
like, they felt they were just cruising, like, an easy street is the term, I think. Michael,
not by points, but no, just in how it felt and how it was flowing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they had control, I think. Then Cullum O'Neill, there was that red card incident where he just happened to be the one to get sent off for a dig. Mick Lyons was, you know, doing typical Mick Lyons job on him, and he reacted to a kind of a tempestuous slap of the ball out of his hands. He kind of gave him a bit of a hook. Mick Lyons, to his credit, walked away just holding his cheek, didn't make a meal of it, but he was sent off, he got the line. So you can imagine then, like, he had to sit through the rest of the game watching with his tension must went up a few levels, like. But they got in at half time, they were still in touch, and then they just kicked on, like, and it was just a case of.
And is there
points,
any story
really,
from the half time, or was there? Not really, as much has come out from that.
No, it wasn't. It really wasn't as, like, you know,
dramatic
that,
as the cannon and the, and the, like, buckets of water.
Exactly. No, it wasn't at all. In the league final a few months earlier, like, there was more of those kind of histrionics, I think we've might have touched on, with, like, there was a particularly nasty game, and afterwards Billy Morgan got down his hands, or got down his knees rather, and said, I pray to God that we'll meet again in the All-Ireland final, because we'll be there. So their prayers came true, and they met their arch rival, which they wanted to beat, like. There was no panic really at half time. I don't think it was just a tactical chat, really, more than anything. There wasn't any need for reminding people what was on the line here. Like, well,
it might be a good point then, just to set the second half up, or some of the incidents of the second half up, with the story of John Cairns and Ger Cunningham, the two Toker men, is it?
Yep.
Both for the Bars, and their careers had shadowed each other.
Yeah.
One chose hurling and one chose the football, and they backed each other up.
Yeah, exactly. So
because there was a big save in the hurling, wasn't there?
Yeah. So 2 weeks previously, obviously, Cork had won the hurling, and one of the turning points was Joe Cunningham basically making a save with his face. Like, he didn't know a whole lot about it, even though he came down and closed down the angle as he always would. And at the same time, the umpire thought it went wide, so it was, you know, a big turning point there. Like, and then, you know, fast forward to 2 weeks, and John Kearns, who was his St. Finbar's teammate, they trained with each other. One was the hurling number one, and one was the football number one for club and county, and they drove each other on a bit, like, and they were both from Marwood and Toker, their neighbours, and maybe a year or two between them, like. So then it was almost like an identical situation, really, and Brian Stafford came through, and John Corns raced out and made a really big save, like, and it's really, I don't know, uncanny, really, the way that the two incidents mirror each other, like. And that was a massive, massive turning point in that particular game, like. And but John Corns said afterwards, to his credit, really, I don't know if it's true, that he didn't know much about it either. It was just a case of coming out and doing what you're supposed to do as a goalkeeper, and they got the bunks, like.
And that's it. So it was nip and tuck for points through the second half, but then just sort of out of nowhere, Cork pulled ahead by four.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a couple of big frees from Larry Tompkins, you know, typically put over, and Mick McCarthy, who was a really important player. He's probably on the fringes over those years, but he started that day and he scored a couple of big points. John Cleary came on. You know, like that season probably is characterised by people who were on the fringes really stepping up, like that Munster final before that, you know, Cullum O'Neill and Mick Slocum kind of nailed his place down. You know, so the same thing happened that day. Like it was really a group effort panel type of a thing. Like, so there wasn't one big score from a star, and I thought it was just the team functioning really well, and yeah, they got over the line. It was amazing.
And then the whistle blows, and I remember the 50-50 cashback song, "We just won the double." Yeah. "We just won the double," and it must have been a magic moment, and and there it is.
Yeah, and should be said, Teddy McCarthy made history that time then by winning, you know, 2 All-Ireland senior medals in a fortnight. An incredible performance and achievements for any man, like, and he'll always be remembered for that. He went back into the dressing room and it's like almost like a Field of Dreams scenario with Jack Lynch is sitting there, and he congratulates him. Dennis Walsh, it should be said, won an All-Ireland hurling medal 2 weeks previously. He was on the football panel, but in those days, if you weren't on the bench, basically you didn't get a medal. So he was, you know, really cruelly denied a medal, but he played a huge part really in those two panels. And it's indeed, I think even now he'd get a medal. Like, so he was denied history that in that way, but he's not particularly bitter about it. I know, like he kind of very philosophical about it.
Yeah, and Jack Lynch, what, 5 hurling medals and one football?
Yeah, I think, yeah. So
he's some hero as well.
Yeah, so he was sitting there with his briar pipe.
Never mind having been Taoiseach, by the way, just in case anyone's wondering, does he know that? Yeah. Does he know that part of it? Was he Taoiseach twice?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And you know, we talked about Meath and the bitterness that certainly the fans had over Tompkins and Shea, but the Cork fans got their own back as they raced on the pitch, seemingly.
Yeah, yeah, they gave it back at that stage. All right, some of them, like Liam Hayes, told me, who was midfield for Meath, he remembers Cork players being really magnanimous and gracious, but you know, I think some Cork fans did hop the fence.
It had been building.
Yeah, you know, completely. Like, it was, you know, that's right, that's the word, like it had been building, and so Cork fans rushing out, and as he remembers it, on their way to congratulate Cork players, they did remind
take
him.
Their opportunity.
Yeah, which is, he says it's fair enough. He knows that a lot of it was silly over those years, that toxic rivalry, I suppose, but it was really compelling, I suppose, looking back on it. It did define that era, like the Cork and Meath thing. And Larry Tompkins actually makes the point, and a few players probably do that. They drove each other on. It's like, you know, McEnroe Borg or whoever, like, you know, they become better because there's that kind of bait in the war on the other side. Like,
I'd missed this when I read it. I spot it now. We've mentioned Kevin Hennessy. He gave up his sort of VIP tickets to the sister and the sister's friend who wanted to sit with all the players.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I'm sure. Yeah. So there was a delegation went to the county board and asked for tickets for the hurlers. So they all went together in their suits, I think, and sat together. But Kevin Hennessy.
So the girls, I'd say, were like, "Give us those tickets." Yeah. So he's in the canal end.
Exactly. Yeah. But then he's spotted. Yeah, obviously. And because there's Kevin Hennessy. We won a double, so they lift him up and hoist him up and carry him out and sing songs or whatever. It's just pandemonium.
Tompkins' speech references Irish immigrants watching the, you know, because again, different Ireland, different time.
Exactly. And especially given his background, he knows well what it's like to be standing in a bar in Manhattan somewhere watching this or listening on a radio. So that was a nice touch. Like his speech, like people kind of perceived Tompkins really as, I don't know, not particularly cuddly character. He's a strong player and a big man or whatever, but like his speech was really emotive, and it went on a bit. Like the RT had to cut it short, actually. Like,
oh, and, that's right.
But he made special reference then to Billy Morgan as well, the man who kind of brought him into the panel and really had created this dynasty, you know, as it was. Like,
and he got the Jack Lynch congratulations as well. We mentioned that. And there wasn't the interview then, and RT didn't get to do the interview with a live interview with the thing, and there was uproar over it afterwards.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that was, I think, because they cut Larry's speech short, there was a lot of complaints over that. Yeah, and they had to make reference on the Sunday game to it.
To apologise for having cut him off. Larry had played with a number of injections to get him through the game. Actually, we haven't mentioned, is it Con Murphy as the doctor, is it?
Yeah, Dr. Con. So he was another, along with Kit Cronin, and like there was a lot of big characters there. Like, he was a huge part of the success, and obviously beyond 1990. But you know, he's jokingly referred to as a sixth selector, and he wouldn't probably apply that to himself. But he was, you know,
but he had really a role bigger than what his role was, almost.
Completely, yeah. He was a conduit really between the players, and like it comes through in the John Fitzgibbon story where he's kind of Gina Man from behind the goal, and he's kind of that kind of kind of arm around the shoulder type guy, as it was when it's needed. Yeah, so he was, I think, in the bar in the Burlington, as you would be the day after in All-Ireland, and Larry walked in and they had a pint together, and he had a look at his leg, which he didn't realise was injured at all, like, and he immediately diagnosed a cruciate, like, and it had transpired that Larry Tompkins had played at least 15 minutes.
And scored 2 points.
Yeah. And he's not hobbling or anything. Like,
how?
Yeah, and he's never the same, I don't know if you'd agree, but I don't think he was ever the same player again after that. Like, that was, you know, that did change him as a player, but, like, amazing.
Hip cartilage, medial ligament and cruciate. Same injury Gascoigne got in Wembley against Forest when he stretched it off. Larry never went down, never got attention until he told me the following day.
Yeah.
Most amazing thing I've seen. Himself and Shafa, he brought a huge amount to that team.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Imagine that.
Unbelievable. Billy Morgan, there must have been some sense of satisfaction now coming back. Or maybe not. Maybe someone as driven as that is almost dead.
Yeah,
but having had the crack off Meath and finally doing it, and with 14 men and everything.
Yeah, I think it definitely was job done all right. Like, and there was satisfaction there that they'd overcome everybody. Like, there was a lot of doubters as well about, you know, there was talk of bottle in 88, and so that word was used a lot in 89, and people like
Neil
Nick Tobin,
give us that one. It was Neil Tobin who said last night that you can take the cork out of the bottle, but you can't take the bottle out of cork. That was to the homecoming, yeah, so there would have been roars.
So, like, that kind of, that was used against them over the years, probably. So they'd really gotten those, you know, to use that phrase again, the monkey was off their back now. Like, so, and I think, like, then it was when you kind of move in to 91, like, you can imagine the partying that went on, like, and the, not partying, but celebrations were huge, like, and every kind of clubhouse in the county had to be visited in every school.
Well, Sam was home.
Yeah. And, like, you know, naturally enough, it was, felt like the end of a cycle almost, like, it was going to be hard to kind of go again, like, so that was the next challenge, not the next book.
That's it. Well, look, we're thank you very much. I've thoroughly enjoyed the chat. Adrian Russell, no, author of The Double and editor of the42.ie, How Cork Made GAA History. But maybe it might be a nice way to finish just to mention, like, Cork and Meath needed each other.
I think so.
And whilst they hated each other, I think as the years go on and you look back and everything else, and the John Cairns funeral, I think, was a time where they realised the futility of the hatred and the fact that actually they'd been sort of the yin to each other's yang.
Yeah, there was probably Michael McCarthy passed away first in a car accident, sadly, and you know, Robbie O'Malley and maybe a couple of other Meath players came to the funeral or went to the funeral in Skibbereen, and that was hugely appreciated, and that was the first kind of sign of a thawing really between the two panels. And then I suppose a few years after that, John Curran sadly passed away after a long cancer battle, to use that word. And like, it was the Meath players kind of got together and said, okay, let's all go. Like, and it was a proper delegation, and that was usually appreciated. And there was a coming together of the groups in the Lock Tavern, I think it was, and they had a good night. And, you know, they kind of did realise, as far as what they've said to me, that, you know, it was football, really, like, and it kind of got out of hand here and there, but, like, there's very good relationships now. There's, you know, various visits for retirement parties, and there was a couple of players at a wedding of a child, and I know John Kearns Jr., who won the football title with the Bears a couple of years ago, he got various texts from Meath players, like, so it's actually lovely, you know. I think that there is that kind of human element to it, and any of those rivalries have been put to one side, although, you know, they would still argue that, and the Meath players have to me, that Meath were better, and I'm sure Cork would say the same, even though
but the final words of the book are let me see.
Dennis Walsh.
It was fabulous to meet them, and for me to realise it's only a game. It's important, and it was important at the time, but it's more important now that we have something together. And that's kind of it. They battled together, didn't they?
Yeah.
Out in the fields. But I'm glad Cork came out. I'm glad, I'd say Cork are glad they came out on the right side of it, finally.
I suppose the point is, it was for the players, it was a historic thing for the county, and they'll always have that, and fans absolutely love looking back on it, as I well know. But for the players, they have those memories of, you know, being in pubs in Brentford on trips, or New York, or in Grand Canaria, whatever, Croke Park. They went through the battles and the laps of Croke Park and Perky Cueve, rather, I suppose. So, I hope they think that this book is a reflection of some of that.
I think you did a fine job. Well done. And will it happen again?
Yeah.
the million dollar question.
Yeah, the Santy double, is it this year? We're going to get the two All-Irelands within a week of each other in December. It'd be nice to have the homecoming.
Yeah, well, Christmas. Yeah, except for the no crowds would be a shame.
It would be sad,
it's not
it?
The same.
No.
I love my sport and I love still watching it, but at this current COVID moment as we record this podcast interview, whilst we'd love the double to come back as the Santa double, Jesus, with no one there for it.
No, it'd be weird, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't be the same thing.
Yeah, next year maybe.
We'll get back to those good times. Adrian, thank you so much for your company. Adrian Russell, The Double, How Cork Made GAA History. Pleasure chatting with you on Red FM this evening.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a Red FM podcast. For more extra content, go to redextra.ie.